picture like a completely ordinary Tuesday morning.
Right, just a normal day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're sitting at your desk, maybe fueled by, I don't know, a third cup of coffee.
We've all been there.
You're just squinting at your dual monitors, and that is exactly where Maya Chen was. She's an AI engineer.
Right, running routine tests.
Yeah, she's tweaking weights and biases to align her company's artificial intelligence with, you know, human values, which is...
It's wildly ironic in hindsight.
So staggering. But it's just another day in the tech world, right? Right up until her news app pings. She looks up, and the live feed shows this, I mean, it's a 60-mile-wide... crystalline artificial moon.
Yep.
Just settling into Earth's orbit.
It just completely shatters the mundane. I mean, 1 minute humanity is worried about like software bugs and quarter end projections.
Right.
And the next, this shimmering, impossible structure is just consuming the sky.
No.
It fundamentally alters the trajectory of our entire species in like this span of a heartbeat.
So welcome to this deep dive into the harrowing events of the transcend or die source material.
Yeah, it's a heavy one.
It really is. We are pulling from a comprehensive account of Earth's first and, well, second contact with two factions of this alien species, the Verzani and the Tambori.
We're tracing the whole ensuing cosmic holy war.
Exactly. The war that basically turned our planet into an incidental battlefield. And we're going to look at humanity's desperate fight just to, you know, survive the crossfire.
And I think it's important to state our mission for today. The goal of our analysis isn't just to recap a timeline of an alien invasion.
No, not at all.
The source material presents this as the ultimate test of human agency. We're looking at what actually happens when an unimaginably advanced intelligence weaponizes biology and dogma.
Yeah, humanity was backed into this impossible corner, forced to make a staggering choice between a sterile, forced eternity or a really messy mortal freedom.
It is a tough choice.
It is. I want you, the listener, to really put yourself in Maya's shoes as we go through this.
Just imagine it.
If the sky opened up tomorrow and a voice offered you an immediate end to all your pain, all your vulnerabilities, but the cost was like surrendering your biological existence entirely, what would you choose?
It's a paralyzing question. And it is the exact ultimatum the Verzani delivered.
Right, because 3 hours after that massive mothership shows up,
40 identical shuttlecraft just descend over Earth's major population centers, like all at once.
And in Seattle, where Maya lived, this luminous floating sanctuary just materializes right above Elliott Bay.
And then we meet Kethvar,
the supreme voice of the Verzani.
Right. And the way he communicates is, well, it's chilling. He doesn't just hijack TV broadcasts like you'd see in a movie.
No, it's everywhere. He appears on every single digital display on the planet simultaneously.
Tablets, smartwatches.
Even the tiny LCD screens on office fire alarms.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
But he doesn't arrive shouting about, you know, conquest or destruction. He's incredibly calm.
Yeah, he offers humanity a choice. He says, embrace the path of the left helices and transcend your biological body into this eternal unified state.
Or refuse the upgrade and face the end of your existence.
It's phenomenal psychological manipulation.
Oh, absolutely. The Verzani had clearly been intercepting Earth's broadcasts for decades. They understood our archetypes.
They didn't come off as conquerors. They framed themselves as saviors.
Exactly. I mean, their initial messages quoted Shakespeare. They quoted human scripture.
Just trying to build a false bridge of trust.
Right. But underneath that velvet glove was an absolute iron fist. Because the moment Kefar offered this choice, they deployed what we later called a stasis field.
This stasis field completely rewrites the rules of engagement. I mean, it instantly neutralized the militaries of the world.
Fighter jets just lost thrust.
Nuclear silos went completely dark.
All right.
But let's dig into how the source material describes this. It's not just some magical dampening wave.
No, it operates on a very specific physical principle. The field was essentially a localized dampener of rapid kinetic energy transfer.
And complex exothermic reactions, right?
Yes. It essentially raised the activation energy required for certain chemical and mechanical processes.
So, like, if you try to ignite gunpowder inside a gun chamber to fire a bullet,
the field suppresses the combustion. The reaction just fails.
And if you have high-velocity turbines spinning in a jet engine, the field creates this overwhelming friction that just grinds them to a halt.
It forces a mandatory planet-wide de-escalation of complex threats. They neutralized our entire defensive capability without firing a single shot.
It trapped the whole population in this state of helpless contemplation. You couldn't fight back. You just had to listen.
It feels exactly like a mandatory operating system update.
Yes. That's exactly it. An OS update, but applied to the human soul. You know that pop-up on your phone?
The one you keep hitting, remind me later on.
Yeah, exactly. But this time, the terms and conditions are accept the new biological code or be deleted. It completely bypasses the concept of consent.
And you see this ideological split happen right away. Maya sees the architecture of a cage.
Because of her AI alignment background, she sees the loss of agency.
Right. But her sister, Sarah, has a totally different reaction.
Which is so crucial to understanding this. Sarah was a pediatric oncology nurse.
She spent her life holding dying children.
Right.
Witnessing the absolute worst limits of human suffering.
Yeah, so when this advanced intelligence arrives and promises to make all the pain stop, to offer this eternal painless resonance.
Her conversion isn't born out of stupidity.
No, not at all.
It's driven by this profound empathetic exhaustion. The Verzani dogma preyed perfectly on the fatigue of the human condition.
And that exhaustion drove thousands into those glowing sanctuaries where they just vanished, supposedly transcending.
But for the skeptics who refused, this forced de-escalation meant they had to completely reinvent survival.
They had to go underground, and paradoxically, they had to go backward in time. Maya joins the Seattle-based resistance cell called Echo.
And without digital infrastructure, communication is, like, hurdle number one.
The stasis field made modern military comms useless, so Echo had to build a shadow network.
Enter James Garrett.
Yes, Maya's close friend. He was a former penetration tester, a cybersecurity guy, and he builds this localized mesh network in, like, 2.5 weeks.
Out of discarded hardware. It's such a clever workaround in the source material.
He didn't build a new internet. He used old disconnected smartphones. The ones people just throw in their junk drawers.
Since cell towers were dead, he flashed custom firmware that utilized the phone's native Bluetooth and Wi-Fi direct.
Creating a massive asynchronous sneaker net.
Yeah, as resistance members walked through the ruins of Seattle with these phones in their pockets, the devices would silently ping each other.
Swapping encrypted packets of data in microseconds whenever they were close.
And he used this to create heat maps of Verzani patrol routes.
Right, logging areas where alien interference spiked. So when a runner returned to the bunker, that data synced with the main terminal.
Effectively giving Echo a decentralized, delayed radar system. It's an incredible use of analog era tech.
But the combat side is even wilder. I mean, how do you fight heavily armored alien missionaries when guns don't work?
You recruit the local chapter of the society for creative anachronism.
Wait, the medieval reenactors?
Literally them.
Yeah.
Echo organized strike teams armed with broadswords, spears, heavy iron maces.
Because it skirts the rules of the stasis field. The field suppresses high-velocity kinetic energy, right?
Right.
But a human swinging a solid piece of sharpened steel is relying on biological muscle ATP. It's low-velocity, high-mass kinetic transfer.
It falls right below the dampening threshold. It's brilliant.
It really highlights a deep tactical divide. The Verzani thought in binary extremes, transcend or end.
Flawless machinery or complete stasis. But humanity operates in what James calls quantum superpositions.
We're messy. We're highly adaptable. We'll use primitive brute force when elegant solutions fail.
Exactly.
But I have to question the Verzani's intelligence here. I mean, they can travel light years, hack every screen on Earth, but they leave a loophole big enough for a medieval broadsword.
Yeah, it seems crazy.
Is it arrogance? Do they just not care?
It's likely a matter of threat modeling based on extreme superiority. When you build 60-mile-wide crystalline moons, you don't calculate the statistical probability of a localized mammal hitting your troops with a heavy rock.
Wow. Yeah, they didn't view us as a military threat at all.
Just a biological resource? The losses they took from analog weapons were probably just an acceptable margin of error in their grand algorithm.
Which makes the human resistance feel even more desperate. They're not fighting to win. They're fighting to prove they exist.
The rebellion was deeply psychological.
Yeah, the source material focuses on Nadine, this traumatized former paramedic in the bunker. She draws these hyper-realistic charcoal portraits of the people who vanished into the sanctuaries.
And James plays that beat-up, dented harmonica.
They're actively preserving grief, analog art, and imperfection against this force that just wants to sanitize reality.
It's the ultimate defense of the human condition, weaponizing their own flaws to prove that pain and memory have value.
But just as Echo establishes this fragile rhythm, the entire paradigm violently shifts.
A second mothership enters Earth's orbit.
And this one isn't pristine. It's deeply battle-scarred and scorched.
The Tambori. Earth suddenly realizes we aren't the target of a colonization effort.
No, we're ground zero for a cosmic religious war, and we just happen to be in the way.
The Timboris are led by Vel'Tar, and their dogma is the exact inverse of the Verzani.
They preach the right helices.
Right. They don't offer gentle transcendence. They preach purification through trial, suffering, and fire.
Consciousness has to be burned clean before it can ascend, and they don't even bother giving us an ultimatum. They just immediately initiate orbital strikes against the Verzani sanctuaries.
The scale's apocalyptic. They deploy warships equipped with maser beams.
Like we use in modern astronomy, right? Microwave amplification.
Yes, but weaponized at an orbital scale. These are beams of concentrated microwave radiation, billions of times more powerful than anything we can make.
And when those beams hit the Verzani's invisible kinetic force fields in cities like Seattle,
the energy has to go somewhere. The beams refract.
The atmospheric displacement is so intense, it literally boils the waters of Puget Sound.
They're flash vaporizing entire city blocks just through the collateral heat wash. It's unimaginable.
But amidst this chaos, there's a human scientist hiding in a bunker, Dr. Raj Patel.
He is the game changer.
He secures biological samples from dead Verzani and Tambori scouts. And his discovery fundamentally changes everything.
The Verzani and the Tambori aren't two competing alien races.
They're the exact same species.
Yes. This is the revelation that anchors the narrative. Dr. Patel discovers that instead of DNA based on a 5-carbon sugar like Earth life,
they operate on an XNA structure, a synthetic genetic polymer using a 6-carbon hexose sugar.
But the critical part is the chiral divergence.
Mm.
Chirality refers to the geometric orientation of a molecule.
Right, its handedness.
Exactly. Like your left and right hands, they're mirror images, but you can't perfectly superimpose them.
So Dr. Patel finds that the Verzani biology is entirely left-handed genetic helices.
And the Tamboris are exclusively right-handed.
Literal genetic mirror images. It's like a spiraling staircase where half the population is biologically forced to walk up the left side and the other half is forced up the right.
That is a perfect analogy.
But why does a molecular quirk trigger a universe-spanning war? We have left and right-handed people on Earth. We don't glass each other's cities over it.
Well, it comes down to the lock and key mechanism of enzymes.
Okay.
On a molecular level, left-handed enzymes cannot bind to right-handed substrates. And when a species has reached a technological singularity where their biology and machinery are entirely integrated.
Oh, I see. Where their ships and neural networks require biological compatibility.
Yes. Chirality becomes a hard biological firewall. They literally cannot interface with each other.
So if a Verzani tries to upload their consciousness into a Tambori network, the system just rejects the code.
They can't interbreed. They can't share resources. They can't merge their consciousness. What they framed as a religious holy war is, at its core, a brutal fight for biological monopoly.
That is such a tragic irony. They're an impossibly advanced species, but they couldn't overcome a genetic mutation in their own history.
So they projected it onto the universe as a crusade.
And humanity is just caught in the crossfire. The war escalates until they're fighting point blank in orbit. The energy unleashes, overwhelms both motherships, and they just obliterate each other.
Raining debris across the upper atmosphere. And the moment those ships die,
the stasis field breaks.
The kinetic dampening hub was tied to their orbital presence. The invisible weight on Earth's physics just lifts.
And the narrative describes this so viscerally. A Tambori scout breaches the echo bunker, and a fighter reflexively pulls the trigger on an old AR-15 they were using as a club.
It actually fires.
The combustion works, the alien bleeds, and the moment Echo realizes physics are back to normal, they immediately mount a desperate raid on Cascade Outfitters.
That supply run perfectly illustrates the new world. Paper money is totally worthless.
Maya and her team haul duffel bags of painkillers, antibiotics, gold jewelry.
Trading life-saving medicine for crates of AR-15s and shotguns.
They're gearing up for a very human kind of war to reclaim their city. They take that newly acquired firepower straight into the failing Verzani sanctuary.
Because Maya's sole mission is to find her sister Sarah.
Before the Tambori wipe out everyone inside, or the sanctuary collapses, they fight their way to the inner core, and what Maya finds is deeply unsettling.
She finds Sarah inside a stasis pod, physically perfectly preserved.
But as she's revived, it's obvious she's been altered. Her neural pattern has been aggressively hybridized with Verzani XNA code.
This is a massive philosophical problem.
It really is. Maya is talking to Sarah, and Sarah possesses all her old memories, laughs at the same inside jokes, but her underlying operating system is running on hybrid alien code.
She even tells Maya her own memories feel distant, like someone else's dream.
It's the classic Ship of Theseus paradox.
The Verzani promised eternal continuity of the self, but the mechanics suggest something darker. They mapped Sarah's synaptic connectome in perfect high resolution and then ran that map on an XNA substrate.
But does that transfer the consciousness? Or just create a perfect clone while the original died?
Exactly. If you copy a file to a new hard drive, then smash the original laptop, is it the same file?
To the network, yes. But to the subjective experience of the human soul. We don't know if the original Sarah survived or if Maya rescued a biological machine programmed to emulate her.
And the source material leaves that ambiguity completely intact, which is brilliant.
Maya decides the distinction doesn't matter to her. She just wants her sister back.
But the terror of the Verzani offer is laid bare. They delivered a high fidelity preservation that completely blurs what it means to be conscious.
And the aftermath on Earth reflects that same ambiguity. The ships are destroyed. The stasis field is gone, but we don't just rewind the clock to a normal Tuesday.
The psychological scars are permanent. War orphans painting broken double helices on shelter walls.
But humanity makes a defining choice. They don't destroy the alien tech left behind.
They start actively reverse engineering it.
Pulling apart the stasis generators, they survive, but they're stepping into the cosmos carrying the tools of their invaders.
They refuse the mandatory upgrade, but they're choosing to evolve on their own terms.
It's a phenomenal ending. And if we pull this back to you, the listener, right now in your everyday life.
We aren't facing 60-mile-wide crystalline moons.
No, but think about the tech landscape we navigate. We are constantly surrounded by algorithms and platforms demanding we optimize ourselves.
We're pressured to transcend our analog habits for a frictionless, pain-free digital existence.
Usually at the direct cost of our privacy or our individuality, the modern tech promise is very similar. Accept the terms and conditions and let the system run your life.
But as Maya and the Echo Resistance showed, there is profound power in retaining the right to question those flawless systems.
Perfection is very often just a behavioral cage wrapped in a really compelling sales pitch. The struggle to remain human is the struggle to retain your agency. So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. Think back to Maya, sitting at her desk before the sky changed, trying to manually align an AI with human values.
A nearly impossible task.
If a superior intelligence, whether it's an AGI we build right here or an alien one that arrives tomorrow, offered you a flawless, pain-free eternity. But the absolute price was surrendering the very flaws, the griefs, and the messy analog choices that construct your identity.
The things that make you you.
Would you take the upgrade? Or would you choose to remain beautifully, defiantly broken?